I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Syria is the question still without an answer after President Trump's weekend air raid on chemical arsenals near Damascus. 6 years now, Syria is the moral crisis with many major players and not a life-saving motive in the lot of them. It's the eyesore you cannot look at or avoid. And still, in Trump time, Syria is a measure of the superpower abroad, what we say and do and why. Is there a Trump doctrine we are puzzling this hour, in action or words, coming out of Syria, looking ahead in the Middle East? Part of the trick is to make sense of the commentary, like the bizarre hope in the Wall Street Journal's fervent lead editorial this week that the U.S. should turn Syria into Iran's Vietnam. Just a few decades of bloodletting. The cable television diet features strong opinions from pundits best known for their checkered records, like these.
Judy Miller, let me ask you, because you have such rich experience in the region and in the area, do you agree with the seriousness of the message sent with last night's strikes?
What struck me about the missile strike last night was its targeted, limited, but absolutely precise objective in terms of what it wanted to accomplish.
Fox News national security strategist Sebastian Gorka, I begin with you.
The president is not an interventionist, and I know the left doesn't believe this. He is a very, very compassionate man. But he believes in a simple saying, for evil to triumph, all you need is for good men to do nothing.
Fareed Zakaria, GPS.
I support President Trump's use of American military power this week, especially since this time it was done in collaboration with Britain and France. It is perhaps a sign of America's few options that on Syria, despite his protestations and his constant digs at his predecessor, Donald Trump has morphed into Barack Obama.
Our keynoter, Jeffrey Sachs, is the development economist at Columbia University in New York. Jeff, you get to see all the troubles on the planet, including Syria in 2011, at the right hand of Kofi Annan, when the UN Secretary General was trying to nip a Syrian civil war in the bud of the Arab Spring. You're off the grid of most Democrats on Syria, Jeff. You write now, Trump had it right. Yes, a rarity. You said, about getting out of Syria, while the security state, you said, was wrong yet again. We need your history here, Jeff Sachs. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you. And interesting that Fareed Zakaria says that Trump has morphed into Barack Obama. Well, in a way, that's true. That would mean more war, aimlessness, running around in circles, an ongoing, unfortunately, bloodbath in Syria, because most of this did take place under Barack Obama. It's hard to know exactly where to start the history. Chris, you could start 100 years ago when the Ottoman Empire fell and Britain and France became the imperial powers and started fighting immediately, trying to conquer the resources of the region, the oil of Iraq and so forth. And in a way, the U.S. took over the imperial mantle of Britain and France after World War II, and the U.S. has been enmeshed in Middle East wars, certainly since 1979, when the CIA acted to send jihadists to Afghanistan in order to provoke the Soviet Union coming in, exactly what the Wall Street Journal this week wants to do in Syria. Well, Afghanistan's basically been at war ever since. It's been as great a disaster for that country as one could imagine.
Jeff, I'm just wondering, when you and Kofi Annan saw potentially a break in the permanent war, what was it?
Well, it was only a fleeting break because basically, in 2011, the U.S. and a number of regional allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Qatar, all saw the chance to push Assad overboard, a regime change operation, that is, each for their own reasons. Turkey, because this would be the chance to put in a Muslim Brotherhood country, a government friendly to Erdogan. The Saudis, because that would be the chance to push Iran out of Syria. Israel, basically the same. And the U.S. was on a game plan also that General Wesley Clark has been telling us about for years, which is that as early as 1991, 1992, the neoconservatives in the United States, post-Cold War, saw the chance to clean up the Middle East of all of its Soviet and then Russian allies, and Syria was on that list, as was Iraq, as was Libya. So in a way, Chris, this is a long-standing story, but the real current story started in 2011. The Arab Spring broke out, and all of these allies of the United States said, okay, now the government in Tunisia has been replaced in Egypt. Now let's push aside Bashar al-Assad. I'm pretty sure that they thought this would be a matter of weeks, as it had been in Egypt and Tunisia. Immediately, Turkey started giving sanctuary and support to some breakaway rebels in the Syrian army. But just as soon, Qatar and Saudi Arabia started sending in outside forces, arming them, jihadists going in, all with the idea of knocking Assad out. And President Obama declared in August of 2011, Assad must go as part of this strategy. By 2012, Obama had sent the CIA in a formal presidential finding, which we've never seen to this day, but it is called Sycamore Timber, Timber Sycamore, excuse me, a CIA covert operation to overthrow the government of Syria. Never explained to the American people, of course, never voted by Congress, in partnership with the Saudi Arabia in particular, but all these other countries that I've mentioned as well. And then to the question you asked me, in 2012, Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the UN, was the UN envoy to try to put forth a peace plan because already a war was underway. And it was called a civil war, but it was already a proxy war. All these outside powers were coming in. Well, Kofi Annan had a deal on the table, except the U.S., that is President Obama's administration, would not accept it, because the U.S. was demanding the immediate replacement of Assad. Those were the U.S. terms. And Assad wasn't going anywhere. The regime change operation was not successful. This escalated into more and more of a bloodbath, millions of people displaced, hundreds of thousands killed. Then ISIS broke off from some of the jihadist groups that had gone into Syria. The U.S. started fighting ISIS. Then Russia came in 2015, not as the provocation, but years after the United States had sent in the CIA, Russia and Iran backed Assad and made sure that he would remain in power. And that's Jeff, where we are, Chris. This is now seven years of war.
I'm thinking we're not regime changes at Open Source, but if there was a regime in the world you might have wanted to change, it might have been Assad's in Syria. And still, I don't understand the covertness. President Obama effectively outsourced the American interest to the CIA, and we never saw it straight after that. I still kind of...
There are reasons for that. First, Obama wanted to have it both ways. He did not, and I'd say to his credit, want to put the U.S. military directly in there. So he wanted a regime change light, put the CIA in as a coordinator, but get the big money and a lot of the armaments from the countries in the region and what their money would buy. Well, this was a debacle, but trying to have it halfway doesn't work. He also didn't want to overtly violate international law, but of course, that's exactly what he was doing. This is directly against the United Nations Charter. It's simply not allowed to overthrow another country's government, except under two conditions. One is that you're doing it in self-defense, which obviously was not the case here. And the second is you have a vote of the UN Security Council, which also was not the case here because Assad had his allies in the Security Council.
Jeff, with all that as background, read what President Trump has done in the way of doctrine, in the way of implications to the future.
Trump's instinct is, get out of here. He doesn't care so much that Russia remains an ally of Syria. And Trump basically had it right that this is a waste of time. The security establishment is in a tizzy because, first, we never leave when we go someplace. We want bases and the underlying forces that put us there in the first place, Israel's interests, Saudi's interests, and so forth. Those are seen to remain, and the neocons always believe that every war can be won, even if it hasn't been won, just like we used to argue about Vietnam after so many years. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole establishment in the United States which is horrified at the fact of ever leaving, and no doubt Trump is hearing from everybody, no, you mustn't. Now we see every day in the Wall Street Journal today, typically, new Islamist group rises in Syria, front, full page, center. It's always like this. You mustn't leave. There are stories today. If we leave, then a war of Israel and Iran is inevitable. Inevitable. Not something that could be avoided or prevented. Inevitable. So these are always the powerful reasons. We heard you can't leave. This would threaten the southern flank of NATO. Well, that's the oldest domino theory, which goes back at least 50 years.
Hold it there, Jeff Sachs.
There's never a time to leave.
I love to hear the dissenting voice on the Democratic side. Coming up, the telltale disarray on Syria on the right of the spectrum, too, with the anti-imperialist Pat Buchanan and the editor of The American Conservative, Daniel McCarthy. We're talking about Syria. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source on Syria and us in the Trump era. Welcome, Daniel McCarthy. The conservative, in the name of your magazine, means to me, among other things, not neoconservative. More libertarian than Republican, maybe. More Bill Buckley-ish than Buckley's own National Review today. More Barry Goldwater than Donald Trump. But it's for you, Daniel McCarthy, to calibrate your conservative take on Donald Trump in foreign policy after this second swipe at Syria. What's he committed to?
Well, you know, I think Donald Trump is actually committed to very little here. This was a mostly symbolic strike. It may have taken out some Syrian chemical weapons facilities, but the chemical weapons in question, certainly chlorine, and even to a certain extent sarin, can be recomposed very easily. These are capabilities that plenty of non-state actors have begun to have. And so, you know, simply the idea that a few missile strikes will take out some sophisticated equipment and therefore stop the Assad regime from ever reattaining these weapons is incorrect. What these are is simply a punitive strike, and it really doesn't commit Donald Trump to very much further in the future, although it does set a precedent. It means that the next time something like this happens, whether it's committed by Assad or whether it's, you know, whoever commits it, there's going to be this pressure once again for the United States to do the same thing, and then there's going to be additional pressure because people are going to say, look, we've done this twice now. We did it in 2017. We've done it in 2018, and neither time did it stop chemical weapons from being used in Syria. Therefore, the hawks, the interventionists, are going to say, now it's time for something more. Now it's time for, you know, more U.S. advisors. Some are already there. Maybe it's going to be, you know, U.S. Ground troops. Maybe it's going to be something much more elaborate. So this is really a sort of attempt by stages to pull Donald Trump into a much wider conflict. But it seems to me that Donald Trump is very reluctant to get involved. As Jeffrey Sachs had said, his instincts simply are not you know, on the side of the kind of expansive ideological ambitions that neoconservatives and others have. Donald Trump is very much, he's a businessman. He's a guy who likes to kind of solve problems in a blunt way, in a quick way, as opposed to getting sucked deep into a kind of quagmire where things have to be constantly, you know, you're constantly struggling against the tide to try to make any kind of headway. I think Donald Trump knows that so much of the Middle East is a dead loss to the United States.
Daniel McCarthy, what would you have said, what would you have done about chemical weapons in the hands of the Syrian regime?
I think the United States cannot play the role of global policeman. We can't say that any time a regime or a non-state actor uses chemical weapons, that this is something that requires the United States to come in with cruise missiles and with other kinds of munitions to try to make a symbolic strike and pretend as if that's going to change the situation. The people who have the most interest in stopping the use of chemical weapons and the proliferation of such weapons in the Middle East are the people of the Middle East themselves, including the other regimes in the region. They are the ones who should have primary responsibility for punishing Assad and for punishing any other actor that may use these kinds of weapons. And in the absence of people within the neighborhood basically policing themselves, there's simply very little that the United States can do, because we do not understand the complexities of the region, and all we have are our moral ideals and our missiles. And those are very crude instruments indeed when it comes to matters as sectarian and politically complex as the Middle East is.
Jeff Sachs, I want to hear you on this interesting sort of convergence of Democrats outside the fold and Daniel McCarthy outside the Republican. But I'm still unclear as to what you think would happen if Trump took your advice and said, we're out of here. Maybe his own instinct too. But then what between all these hostile parties?
I think that the best shot of this is that we go back with Russia in the Security Council, and we try to avoid any kind of ensuing war that might come in to fill the vacuum, this idea that Israel and Iran would then be confronting each other. Actually, Russia doesn't want that any more than we do. Russia is fairly close to Israel as well as Iran, would like to keep the two of them apart. We actually don't have deeply divergent interests with Russia in this. And the Security Council can reach agreements, as it did in the agreement with Iran, actually, on the nuclear, that is pretty effective. That's why it would be a shame if Bolton and the real hardliners around Trump, although that one, I think Trump's instinct's probably wrong, or he's been ill-advised on that. If he tried to sink that agreement at the same time, the Iran agreement, the Syria problem won't settle down. But in short, Chris, the difference of staying in, or the opposite of staying in is, or the alternative to staying in, I should say, is not simply to walk away. It is to try to arrange a diplomatic framework with China, with Russia, and with our friends that are always happy to go to war with us. So Fareed shouldn't have been so surprised. The UK and France have so much imperial nostalgia that they never let an opportunity like this.
Yeah, Macron has been nominated now, Jeff, to be the Donald Trump's Tony Blair.
Absolutely. And by the way, it was, of course, the same triumvirate that bombed Gaddafi
in Reagan time
in 2011. So I'm not very impressed with the fact that we have that three-way coalition. We always or almost always have that three-way coalition. Go to the Security Council, because when the P5 agree on something, you actually get something done. And Russia and the United States do not have divergent interests in this case, not deeply divergent, only to neocons who believe that the United States should have military bases everywhere and Russia zero. If that's your view, then we're stuck.
Daniel McCarthy, I hear both you and Jeff saying, in effect, that our own relentless national security state, the missiles, but the mentality too, is a large part of this problem.
Well, it certainly is. And I think part of the difficulty is simply that we Americans have this idea that every problem has a solution. In the Middle East, that may not be the case. So even though I very much like the idea that we could reach some sort of negotiation through the Security Council that would quell the violence in the region, I'm not so optimistic. It seems to me that Iran and Saudi Arabia are already fighting a very vicious proxy war in Yemen, which we are underwriting and supplying the Saudis with arms. It seems to me that this is going to continue going on in Syria no matter what happens, no matter what the U.S. and Russia might decide. And the possibility of the U.S. and Russia coming together to make a united front in terms of a sort of diplomatic arrangement also just seems very, very difficult at this point, considering the political climate here in the United States, where certainly the Democrats are using Russia as a cudgel with which to beat Donald Trump. And, the Republicans are now so embarrassed by that that they're very eager to show that they can outdo the Democrats in terms of being anti-Russian. So this is, it's a worsening situation. And it seems to me that the best thing to do is for us to just realize how little we can actually affect change here, and that we should sort of divorce ourselves psychologically from what's going on over there.
Daniel McCarthy Jeff Sachs, did you want a word?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I wouldn't be so pessimistic about this. I meet with the diplomats of all of these countries pretty regularly. They, too, are absolutely not wanting endless war. They like to call the United States in to do their bidding for them. But I think it's what you said, Daniel, a few minutes ago, that Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia could actually sort out a lot of their problems if each one of them didn't believe that some superpower is going to come in to do their bidding. And the fact is, the Turks, the Persians, the Arabs have lived with each other for thousands of years in the region. And there have been periods of peace. And it's not just the U.S. It's the colonial world that carved up the remains of the Ottoman Empire and then took over Iran, in effect, by overthrowing Mossadegh in 1953, that have made a huge amount of the mess. So I'm less pessimistic about these countries finding a way forward. And I'm certainly not saying that we can impose a peace, but I am saying that if Russia and the United States and China together say, let's find a framework in which these powers locally can find that equilibrium, I think it can be found.
Jeff Sachs, Daniel McCarthy, say hello to Samuel Moyne. He's the rage among younger Democrats rethinking their own party standard and the foreign policy record, even of Democratic presidents from Kennedy to Johnson, Carter to Clinton, even Obama. He teaches law and history at Yale, and he's hot as a pistol on Facebook. His new book is Not Enough, Human Rights and an Unequal World. How do you read this Trump strike on Syria? Samuel Moyne, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Chris. I agree with your prior guests. It was basically a meaningless show of force. You know, there's some reporting suggesting that Trump wanted to do more this time around, but James Mattis, his defense secretary, told him it was illegal, and so he minimized it. But while I wouldn't buy the notion that Trump, in his heart of hearts, is standoffish, he's been as interventionist through special forces and drones as his predecessors. It's true, Daniel's right, that he's less interested in doing more than pleasing his base in showing that he's decisive. But the truth is this solved nothing, and except that it does set a precedent, and especially a legal precedent, for presidents to engage in military acts we really haven't allowed in recent decades. Usually it's justified by the national interest and involves some kind of a fig leaf of international legality. This time, not at all.
Score the tension, if you can, between Donald Trump and his Pentagon, starting with General Mattis.
Well, it's widely believed, and I think it's right that Secretary Mattis is sort of the last adult in the room, the last expert that people who are outside this Trump revolt within the Republican Party respect. And now, with the departure of so many others, everyone's treating Mattis as a kind of white knight who, as long as he lasts, can restrain Trump from some of his more erratic acts. It seems like that happened in this case, but ultimately he's a subordinate of Donald Trump. And so we have to rely on the fact that Donald Trump it wants to continue some of America's militarism below the radar. But it's clear he also ran as our latest anti-war candidate, just like Obama did. And he wants to be sure not to get sucked in to the kind of war that brought George W. Bush's reputation to its tatters.
So the critical tension may be between Donald Trump, the anti-Bush rebel, and Donald Trump, the wannabe militarist.
I think that's right. I think that's right. You know, he as I've said, when people aren't looking, when you know, he can deploy special forces in 150 countries. That's three quarters of them, as he did last year. Or he can continue the drone program. He does it. But otherwise, he really wants to avoid getting tarred with the brush that George W. Bush did of the interventionist who gets sucked into quagmires. On the other hand, he wants to be able to fund the military to the hilt, which he's done. And be seen on the side of the military, and that will sometimes involve showy uses of force, as occurred just the other day.
Jeff Sachs, that's a contradiction, but it also sounds like a kind of manageable persona to present to the American people. I'm not an interventionist, but I love our troops, and we'll have a big parade to show it, all of it.
Well, I'm probably the least likely to figure out Donald Trump's mind, but I would say that what really is impressive is the underlying persistence. I'll come back to the statement that Trump morphed into Barack Obama. That's not an accident because presidents.
But is it true?
Presidents face a war machine, basically. I don't quite agree with how things were just put because we had 2 weeks of Trump on Syria. The first week was before this chemical attack, and Trump was saying we have to get out, and that was leading to, or we are going to get out very soon, and that was leading right to a hizzy all over Washington. And then came this chemical attack, and then the question is how big will the strikes be? But the previous week was really about Trump saying let's get the remaining troops out of Syria. And it's a little bit of a reminder of when Obama said, let's get the remaining troops out of Afghanistan. And the establishment said, hell no, we need our military bases there. We never leave, by the way. We just don't leave because we want to hold bases. And it's not that Donald Trump had special forces all over the world. So did Obama. So did every president. This is the deep state, and that is our problem, actually. And the experience is that there's a tendency to go to war, and a good president really knows how to keep the foot on the brakes. And a president that wants to have it both ways, that was Obama. You know, this is regime change light in Syria. Okay, I won't put the troops in, but we're going to overthrow him nonetheless with our allies. So that's not so impressive either, let's put it that way.
But would somebody, maybe you, Daniel McCarthy, distinguish between the war machine and the war party, which I imagine Henry Kissinger as the sort of permanent board chairman as long as he lives. But it includes a lot of our press and the networks, too.
Well, that's very true. The war party consists of much of the press. It consists of very many think tanks. It consists of certain academics. And it is fundamentally ideological. I mean, it's driven by some material interests. It certainly is influenced by, you know, lobbyists from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. But ultimately, it has this sort of unworldly, you know, in some ways almost a communistic belief in terms of being able to revolutionize the world and sort of bring about a more perfect kind of justice from pole to pole. This war party, its idealism is, in fact, one of its most dangerous qualities, and it's one reason why no amount of failure seems to be enough to dissuade them from continuing to do what they do. It's almost a religious commitment to a kind of, you know, sort of liberal democratic revolution at gunpoint.
Who's to fight them, Jeff, in the think tanks or on the editorial pages?
Well, I think it's interesting, this question, no amount of failure. The American people do not even understand what's going on. So they can't judge whether there's a failure. The biggest failure of institutions in modern American history is the CIA. There has been no institution that has had more debacles in modern history than that institution. Yet, almost by definition, the failures are kept secret. And once we had the Church Committee, which revealed them, that was back in 1977. It's been a long time since
40 years.
That institution has had the cataloging of failures. Syria is a failure of the CIA because we don't know exactly what they said, but they apparently told the president of the United States, sure, we're in there, we're going to see to the overthrow of Assad. But the American people barely know that because what they really know about Obama, they think, is that he didn't go into Syria.
And the American people barely know, Jeff, that President Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs, said he wanted to cut up the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the wind. Jeff Sachs, we let you go with all kinds of thanks. We love to hear your voice on Open Source.
To be with you.
Thank you, Jeff. Coming up, the tempered roar of Richard Nixon's fighting speechwriter, Pat Buchanan. It's past time, Buchanan says, to be out of the Middle East. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Pat Buchanan is an outlier on the Republican right, the mirror, let's call him, of Jeff Sachs outside the Democratic left. Buchanan was a gunslinger in the Nixon and Reagan White House years. Today, he finds American power way overextended. What he sees in the Trump White House is the president's native isolationist instincts set against his generals and the war party. And this last attack on Syria and its chemicals, he sees as an unstable compromise. I asked Pat Buchanan this week to calculate the actual effects of the disengagement that he would love to see from the Middle East.
This is what those of us who are anti-interventionists or non-interventionists haven't really addressed. There's no question about it. That if, for example, we pull out of Afghanistan, the Taliban will be back in power, and those girls' schools and all those other things that we put up there that were very good in their own right, they will be coming down, and the Taliban will exact retribution against our friends, just as happened in Vietnam. And if the United States gets out of Syria, there's no doubt about it, that Assad, Iran, Russia, Hezbollah, and the Shia militias will have a victory there, and the Iranians will have something of a land bridge out of Tehran through Baghdad, through southern Syria into Lebanon. But to me, I mean, that is just the world of the Middle East. I mean, if we went in with 500,000 troops in occupied Syria, it would go to hell in a handbasket as soon as we got out. So I think we're going to have to let these folks solve their own problems and get our country out. I mean, look at how the Chinese have grown by staying out of wars in the first 18 years of the new century. And what have we accomplished with all the wars we've gotten into in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Yemen, all of them?
Pat, you witnessed close up Richard Nixon's very slow, bloody, maybe reluctant disengagement from Vietnam. I mean, what goes through a president's mind in this process?
It was in the 68 campaign, I think, with the Tet Offensive, and then with Humphrey's bombing halt speech and LBJ's bombing halt, that Nixon, I think, concluded that he had to end the war in Vietnam. And we stopped using the word victory. And some of us felt that the president should have gone all out in his first couple of months, given North Vietnam basically an ultimatum. And if they hadn't corresponded, just going all out with the bombing and shelling and blockade and ended the war. Nixon chose not to do so. I think what he genuinely wanted to do was give the Vietnamese a fighting chance to maintain and secure the freedom and independence we had helped win for them by training them and building up their forces and aiding them and providing weaponry. And I think he believed he had a shot at that. I mean, a lot of people talked in those days that all the Nixon people want is a decent interval. Mm-hmm. In other words, a year or two to get out so that the disaster will not be on their doorstep. Nixon believed he had a shot, at least a chance of prevailing in the longer term in Vietnam, or the South Vietnamese did. And, of course, that was destroyed by Watergate and the congressional cutoff of funds and the wholesale invasion from the North after Nixon left office.
Pat, is there any translating that Nixon experience in the Far East with Trump's dilemmas in the Middle East?
I think there very much is. If we pull out of the Middle East, I mean, if we get out of Syria and pull our troops out of Iraq and pull out of Afghanistan, and if we stop aiding the Saudis in their bombing in Yemen, I think many of those wars, battles, are going to be won by folks we regard as our adversaries and enemies. Things will happen in Afghanistan and in Syria, and our friends in Israel in particular, and Jordan and others, and in Saudi Arabia, I think will be increasingly nervous because they don't want to fight any new wars without the greatest power on earth backing them up and guaranteeing they won't lose.
Could you sell that line to half the Republicans in Congress today, Pat?
No, I don't think so. I think especially with regard to Israel, they're very, very hawkish. I'm sure that the Israelis are behind, or the Israeli lobby and folks who are very pro-Israel are behind this demand that Trump not pull those 2,000 Americans out of Syria. They agree that we're not going to take over Damascus, but I think they fear that our departure would leave their friends vulnerable. I'm sure Bibi's been on the phone a great deal to members of Congress and to the White House that you can't get out of there.
Speak to the ordinary American, Pat, not deeply informed, but frustrated, embarrassed, maybe appalled by 30-plus years of American engagement in the Middle East. What's to be done?
I think most Americans would accept a pullout. When we left Vietnam and Cambodia, they went through horrendous horrors, and the Cambodians especially, but the Vietnamese in the South China Sea, about a million of them, and all the shootings in the street and the re-education camps and the Cambodian Holocaust, where hospitals were emptied on the first day. I think what will happen is that the Republicans fear that this will be seen as the end of America as the number one superpower on earth. I think they will see this as a tremendous setback, and there's no question it will be. I mean, I was back in the argument in 89, 90, National Interest, where I wrote an article. They said, what's the future after the Cold War? And I said, America first, second, and third was the policy we should adopt. And I think if we had, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in Eastern Europe and on the Russian borders. I think the anti-war conservatives, we've done a pretty good job of keeping us out of Georgia and preventing some of these attacks. But it is a never-ending battle, I'll tell you, Chris. I'll give the neocons credit for perseverance.
Let's get bumper sticker simple about this. Is there anything like a Trump doctrine in sight, latent, emerging?
He's been in real estate for 50 years or something, almost as long as I've been in politics and doing issues. So I don't think he's got any deep thoughts on foreign policy, but his instincts are basically anti-war, anti-interventionist, let's be tough on trade, let's be tough in the economic battles for what is right for America. Sort of like 19th century American businessmen. Basically, they wanted to beat the British Empire, but beat them economically. And I think Trump's got an aspect of that. I don't think he sees himself as a sort of George W. Bush when he converted to neoconservatism and declared we were going to end tyranny in our world.
Much less evil, yeah.
Axis of evil, that's right.
That is the chastened, now anti-imperialist voice of Pat Buchanan, and I do love to hear it now and then. Samuel Moyne, what would Jeff Sachs be saying? Pat, lighten up a little bit. These are not eternal, inevitable, inescapable hatreds anywhere. There would be adjustments, but maybe there would be a new world in a Middle East without American firepower everywhere. What do you think?
You know, I think that Daniel and Pat are hearkening back to an old tradition in American life, which is the isolationist one. The worry is that it does border sometimes on a nativism that just disclaims interest in the end in what happens in the rest of the world. You know, we know the old line that faraway places are far away and we know little about them. I think, you know, Jeff would say, and he's right, that the trouble is the militarism and the interventionism, but there has to be a diplomatic solution to Syria if there's going to be one. I do think it needs to begin with the premise that we lost this round because of mistakes, and Iran and Russia won it. And that means Assad's going to stay in power. And for the sake of the Syrian people and the broader region, some kind of diplomatic solution does need to be found through political processes.
Let me ask you, Samuel Moyne, where is the anti-militarist ferment in your rising generation of Democrats? How many of you are there?
I think a great number. And it's, I would look on the bright side, because the very fact that this conversation is taking place shows that the long reign of what you might call the liberal internationalist and neoconservative alliance may be coming to an end. You know, America's great war for the Middle East, conducted by those folks, and really America's broad militarist posture since we recovered from the Vietnamese disaster, it has really been revealed as bankrupt, leaving not just the Middle East, but you know, the world in many respects in ruins. And so there is reason to think that those of us on the left can make some strategic alliances with the old isolationist right and really try to help them as they're battling for the soul of the right.
I want to hear what it looks like, but also just a big point here. Bernie Sanders has made it easy in the Democratic Party to talk about maybe Medicare for all or something extreme, radical, interesting like that, or some form of retiring college debts. We don't hear much of any breakout against the foreign policy establishment. Where is it?
Well, you know, he's certainly, when he, you know, unexpectedly revived the socialist banner just a few years ago, something many of us, you know, thought we'd never see in our lifetimes. It's true he focused on domestic politics, but of course that's what our friends on the isolationist right want us to do. What I think Bernie sees, though, is and he's given one major speech about the need for a new kind of internationalism, is that you can't just leave the world to itself. So I think the younger Democrats and those, you know, on further left who don't think the Democratic Party can be salvaged, really think that it's critical to oppose the war machine. That's, you know, the global arms trade America sponsored, the global basing system, the military procurement process, which does run independently of what any president wants. And then the militaristic ideologies we've seen, which have cut across the center left and center right, uniting Anne Marie Slaughter and Fareed Zakaria and so many others, who have thought America had a role for good, but really only cheered and celebrated when they could see it, you know, because bombs were exploding somewhere.
Humanitarian interventionists like our friend Samantha Power or not-so-friendly Michael Ignatieff, that whole is a big coalition. Daniel McCarthy, I'm wondering how many bodies could you deliver to a coalition with the anti-imperialist Democrats?
Well, you know, I have to actually object to a couple of things that Sam has said, and he said them very well, but I simply think some of his premises here are mistaken, one of which is to use this word isolationism. You know, Pat Buchanan during the Cold War was certainly not an isolationist. He was a Cold Warrior just like most others on the right. The libertarians, who are one of the most strongly non-interventionist elements on the American right today, they are certainly not isolationists. They believe in, you know, free trade and all sorts of economic relations with the world. You know, there is a tradition of realism on the American right, foreign policy realism, which recognizes that if you have a totalitarian power of continental and indeed global ambitions, whether it's Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union, that there is in fact a real U.S. interest, national interest, in going out and fighting that, not just for the sake of ending evil in the world or, you know, battling, you know, abstractions like terrorism, but for the sake of actually defending our country as a nation state. And that kind of brings me to the second point. I think Sam had mentioned nativism is one of the things he kind of worries about with respect to forming an alliance with the right. But it seems to me that the divide here isn't just about, you know, a word like militarism or, you know, some of these other terms that get thrown around. It's really about whether or not the United States is a nation state or the United States has fundamental sort of global commitments. And even though Sam is a very peaceful guy and he doesn't want to express those global commitments in terms of firepower, my fear is that the principles he lays down are going to be taken up by people who want to use military power in order to advance them. And we've seen this in the past. I mean, this is certainly the way in which neoconservatives, for example, use a great deal of human rights rhetoric and democratic rhetoric in order to advance a very, you know, sort of militaristic procedure.
Let me just ask Sam Moyn, I mean, how peaceful are you? Is this a fight you want to join?
You know, I'm the last person to support, you know, humanitarian intervention or humanism at the point of a gun. Not because I think we shouldn't identify with suffering abroad, but because in the face of problems from hell, we often bring solutions from hell. We haven't seen a humanitarian intervention that's worked. Most of them make things far worse, and Exhibit A would have to be the Libyan intervention that's left, you know, that country.
What signals, what slogans, I hate to be slogan, but what examples could you and Daniel McCarthy build a coalition around?
Well, I respect everything you said. It's of course true that many people believe that there's an objective national interest and support a military footprint when it comes to it. Where I think I differ, along with many leftists, is in thinking that we have to identify with, you know, humans everywhere, not just with the national interest, and, you know, think that there is transnational solidarity that matters, especially when foreign governments are killing their own people. But I think we can agree that the kind of military actions that neocons and liberal internationalists have supported to help those kinds of people have failed dreadfully. And of course, the broader war in the Middle East, which has been an American project for 50 years now, things better.
I wonder, can you stretch to transnational solidarity?
Well, that's not the language I would use, but certainly, yeah, you know, one can empathize with one's fellow human beings all over the world, but one has to make priorities. One has to, you know, make choices in terms of where one is most responsible for action and where one has, you know, the most attenuated degree of commitment or involvement. I do think there is common ground to be built here, perhaps first of all around a slogan like first do no harm. And then beyond that, I think we can all recognize that this incredible war machine that the United States has is not an Aladdin's lamp. It's not something we can simply, because we see a problem in the world, we rub this magic lamp, and then a few cruise missiles fly through the air, and suddenly the problem is solved. What we've actually seen in the Middle East has been, in fact, that every time we supposedly solve a problem, like Saddam Hussein, what we wind up doing is simply creating a series of new problems, which wind up becoming actually rather more complicated and perhaps even nastier. So first, do no harm, I think, is the number one principle, not only in medicine, but also in foreign policy.
Yeah, probably better than no dumb wars. But I like Sam Moyn's line that about problems from hell that get addressed by solutions from hell. This is fascinating. Last word, Sam Moyn. We want to hear more from you.
I appreciate being here. I think this alliance between left and right for the sake of a better American foreign policy is worth exploring, as long as we don't treat any region on Earth as a cesspool that can never be improved.
Thank you, Samuel Moyne. Thank you, Dan McCarthy. Thank you, Pat Buchanan and Jeff Sachs. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Done, and the artist Susan Coyne. Paul Kahlo is our engineer. Mary McGrath runs our foreign policy. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.